Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Brent Johnson, welcome back to another episode of Milkshakes Markets Madness. And welcome back to everyone in the Milkshake fam. Just a heads up, I am now doing the traveling for the two of us at the moment. And I am in Mexico, and just like Puerto Rico, it's a lot of concrete and hard tile floors. So if there's a slight echo in this recording, please bear with us. So Brent, how's the weekend starting for you so far? Anything in this past week that comes to mind right away?
Well, I'm actually excited for tonight, John. I'm going to the Barbie movie. So, you know, and I actually, I'm very disappointed. I had ordered a Barbie shirt and I plan to wear it on the show. It goes kind of with our pink motif and, you know, I was going to get in touch with my feminine side and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so anyway, that's going to be kind of my highlight for the day, but that comes later tonight. So anyway, all good.
Sounds like some quality family fun. I wish I had a clever way. I'm transitioning from you talking about your feminine side to markets, but I really don't. Although I will say the markets are feeling a bit brave right now. We have some interesting things going on as far as risk premiums. We talked a little bit last week about how you're using options to play your bearish view, but minimizing some of that downside risk. Well, you know, the cost to take similar positions is at the lowest level in two decades. And the cost for buying protection against a 5% dip in equity markets is fallen to what some have claimed to be the cheapest you'll ever see. So what are your thoughts on what feels like maybe extreme risk taking? Is that what you might consider it?
Yeah, and you know, I'm the first to hold up my hand and say that, you know, I've been wrong. I haven't been overly bearish all year, but I've been tilted bearish all year. You know, luckily I didn't kind of get quote unquote net short until about a month ago. And then luckily when I did get net short, I did it via options rather than just being outright net short. And so while the decay on those options has hurt me a little bit, it hasn't, you know, wiped me out and it hasn't caused this huge drawdown. But I'm the first to say that I'm feeling a little bit of FOMO. And I say that for anybody watching, the part of the reason I say that, it's not because professionals don't feel the same things that you feel. But I think part of being a professional, at least sometimes, is being able to withstand those feelings. And I think that's a big part of this business. But the reason that FOMO is real and the reason that FOMO is something that you have to consider and the reason that the markets could go higher despite all of these reasons that I will tell you why I think they're due to pull back is because there's probably a lot of people that are feeling it even worse than me. Their jobs may legitimately be on the line if they continue to trail their benchmarks. And if the market continues higher, they may be quote unquote forced into either covering shorts and you get a short squeeze, although there's not much chance of a short squeeze anymore because of positioning. But you could still have money on the sidelines come in and push it higher for the people that have been overly bearish. Now, having said all that, I think that it's very possible that the markets continue higher, you know, kind of into August, but I don't think it's worth chasing here. And the reason is for these things that you alluded to. At the beginning of this year, and I know we talked about this over the last couple of weeks, but it's just getting more and more pronounced. At the beginning of the year, the put-call ratio was at its highest level, I think, ever, or at least in the last 10 years or something. And we used that as justification for why the markets might rally in the early part of the year. That is completely reversed. Now the put-call ratio is as low as it's been in a very long time period. The VIX hit its lowest weekly close since January of 2020. Now, think about what happened in February and March of 2020. Right. So the last time we were at these levels on a weekly level in the VIX, it didn't stay there very long. And that's the thing with something like the VIX. It can, when it moves, it can move very quickly. You come out to, you know, the equity risk premium that you were talking about, the gap between the NASDAQ and the 10-year. A number for people who follow DMARC indicators, which is it's basically a counting system which uses a mathematical formula to tell when things are reaching their peak, trends are reaching their peak, or their downtrends are reaching their bottom. Those hit a sell 13 signal this last week. So any one of these individual indicators on its own probably doesn't mean a whole lot. But when you get a number of them over and over and over, and they start adding up, you get 5, 6, 7, 8 of them all together, that to me is a time to say, despite the FOMO you may be feeling, that is the time to be careful, because I know what's going to happen. All these people who've been sitting on the sideline and who are feeling FOMO, when they finally give up and they finally go in, everything's going to roll over and they're going to get hurt the other way as well. So those are the kind of things I'm looking at right now. I'm the first to admit that, my bearish bias has been wrong this year. I'm the first to admit that that could continue to be wrong for a little bit longer, but I'm also kind of steadfast in my belief that we're not going to have a second half of the year that is as smooth sailing as the first half of the year was.
Okay, so one of the things that visually I think is impactful is that NASDAQ versus 10-year chart. You have this really wide alligator jaws. And if NASDAQ represents that momentum, risk-taking attitude, and the 10-year, who knows what it's representing now. It's definitely representing the market sentiment that inflation isn't going anywhere. But to me, in terms of kind of this idea that a rally might be getting exhausted, where some of this movement in equities and the risk assets has felt earlier on, at least the narrative was that this was driven by somewhat of a front running, because eventually the Federal Reserve is going to break something, and they always do during rate hiking cycles. They're going to cut rates, and then off to the races, all these asset prices go. Well, if we've already kind of potentially exhausted that momentum, and if charts can tell us anything about the future, eventually, you know, you're going to see this open mouth alligator jaws collapse a little bit. And so I'm wondering what ultimately is the trigger there. And is this kind of the point that you're talking about, that some of this momentum is just exhausted? And on that point, you know, you have Bitcoin that's up 75% year to date. Earlier in the year, we did a few episodes where you talked about this is more leaning into the end of Q1, where you talked about, hey, where managers could potentially push this market up because they have to rebalance. They're chasing the benchmark. You know, they're getting pressure from whether it's clients or just, you know, outsized performance with indexes overall. Is this somewhat a picking up a nickel in front of a bulldozer moment? Or is there something else here that you think is the market's trying to tell us when we look at, you know, charts like that?
Well, I don't think it's any one thing, but here's where I think it's interesting with regards to those things that you talked about. Number one is people need to realize that markets don't move on the news. Markets move on the anticipation of the news. And that's where the saying, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news comes from. Oftentimes, if you look back at many Fed hiking cycles and then Fed cutting cycles, they typically hike. The economy slows, it rolls over into a recession, and then they start to cut. Typically, it's when they start to cut that equities start to sell off, right? And the reason they're cutting is because equities are selling off. And when that happens, equities typically do not turn around and start rising immediately just because they do one cut. They often have to do more than one, including some other moves, in order to arrest this now descending trend. So that's the first thing I would say. The other thing I would say is it's kind of ironic to me in that last year, it's not ironic, but it will sort of prove the point that I'm talking about, but it's also ironic in that. So last year, the NASDAQ sold off very hard on the anticipation of coming rate hikes, because NASDAQ growth stocks, high growth stocks tend to have an embedded interest rate play in them, because when rates are really low and growth is out there, then growth does very well. And when interest rates are rising, then growth typically does poorly. So last year, the NASDAQ sold off very hard in anticipation of rates rising, which in the latter of the half of the year, and even this year, they did. But now, with equities, or with the anticipation of interest rates coming, or interest rate cuts potentially coming, it continues to rise because it thinks it's going to be more liquidity. But the reality is if it doesn't roll over, then the Fed is not going to cut, right? And so you just keep going up and up and up and up, and then you'd like, to your point, you'll eventually hit that momentum, the end of that momentum, and if for no other reason that it's just exhausted, it falls. So I think that's pretty interesting. So because if part of the reason, so the NASDAQ is rising in anticipation of a cut coming. But the reason the cuts would come is because growth slows. And if growth slows, then NASDAQ, which has gone farther than all the others, is likely to pull back the most, in my opinion. So I think that's pretty interesting. Also, I think with regards to the Fed having to cut and go back to either a pause or a cutting, and even going back to QE, what that would do for fixed income, I think it's a little bit of... what people kind of want to see, whether they're actually going to do it. And the thing, going back to, for them to cut, it would mean that there's something wrong in the economy. There's a hole out there that they are now trying to fill. And unless they immediately go back to a stimulative effort that we know is big enough to fill the hole, that first move is typically not enough to fill the hole. I hope that's making sense, because, for the Fed to cut, to go back to an easy monetary policy or even doing QE, there's got to be a lack of liquidity out there. There's not a lack of liquidity right now, and that's why equities continue to move higher. So for them to all of a sudden move to filling a hole, it must be that there's something out there that we don't see or that the market doesn't understand. And as a result, it's unlikely that the first move the Fed would do would be enough to fill that hole. And that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier. A lot of times when the first cut happens, equities continue to sell off because oftentimes that first move is not enough to counteract the now deflationary forces as opposed to the inflationary forces. I hope that answers your question. I know I kind of rambled a little bit there, but...
Yeah, I think it was a pretty broad question in general. So I think as equally as difficult as it will be for the Fed to fill the hole, I think it was a pretty challenging situation for you to fill the hole that question I laid out in front of you.
Well, I just thought of something else. Let me make this point before we move on. Is the other thing that I think was really interesting this week is, and perhaps we're going to talk about this a little bit more, is there was a Fed meeting, but there was also an ECB meeting, and there was a Bank of Japan meeting. The message out of the ECB is she was more dovish than I think the market was expecting. I think up until then, it was widely believed that she's going to continue hiking because of euro area inflation. But, she wasn't quite as certain about that, and her tone wasn't quite as certain about it. She didn't commit to anything, and the euro pulled back quite a bit, and the dollar rallied because it's kind of the inverse of the euro. And so, again, if that turns out to be the case and euro doesn't continue to rally against the dollar and the dollar does not continue to fall against the euro, as the dollar rises, that decreases liquidity, which then goes into the growth and it goes into the asset prices. And on the other side of the world, the Bank of Japan, they hinted that they are open to the yield curve band widening. Now, they didn't come out and say explicitly that they were going to widen it, but they kind of left it open-ended of when they would do it. But that caused the yen to rally initially. And we've talked before about if the yen were to rally and alongside the dollar, while the euro is falling and other currencies are falling, that's one of the worst things for risk assets, because the yen and the dollar are two of the biggest liquidity providers in the world. And so if those are both tightening against all these other currencies, that could be hell for risk assets. So I thought that was pretty interesting this week as well. So, I think a lot of people tend to focus on the United States. We've talked about this several times, and they've said the Fed, the Fed, the Fed. And I think people need to be saying the BOJ, the BOJ, the BOJ, and the ECB, the ECB, the ECB, the Bank of England, the PBOC. I think some kind of a monetary crisis, slowdown, volatility, explosion, however you want to describe a potential event that would change the direction of markets, could just as easily come from overseas as it would from here inside the United States.
So you put an emphasis on growth, you know, markets trading on expectations. And one of the things that eventually leads to the Fed cutting is when growth slows or stops, maybe we're headed towards aggressively towards recession. Now, with that being said, to kind of put some clarity on your position, or at least a position that you've expressed in various episodes, is although maybe right now you have a little bit of FOMO, and that you've been somewhat bearish on this market uptrend, you have said that this is unlikely to be the Armageddon end of the world situation that so many people like to, you know, scream from a mountaintop about, and that this is more potentially going to be a dip buying opportunity. Whether the market actually lets the Fed slow growth or not with rate hikes is still a big question. And before I kind of open up this Pandora's box of what's happening overseas, the BOJ, et cetera, which we will talk about here, I do want to focus a little bit on the economic data that we had last week because, man, I mean, you had talked about, hey, the Fed's going to raise 25 basis points. It's pretty much baked in. You know, it's priced into the market. They know it's coming. What's more significant is what he says in the press conference after. He had also said last week that, you know, maybe more so than others, you think that September hike is on the table. So, you know, it seemed that Jay Powell was less clear as he normally has been. Something that you kind of gave him credit for was his transparency. Seems a little bit more trying to thread the needle right now. And I had made a joke last week that I feel like these, you know, the central bankers know the data. He's not going to raise rates or make a rate decision 2 days before GDP and try to live in the dark on what that number is. But we did have a surprise GDP number. It was 2.4% versus 1.8 expectations. There was a jump in durable goods. I mean, consumers are out there buying washers and dryers. Who knows? But, there's consumerism is still strong. PCE was solid. This does not feel like 525 basis points of Fed rate hikes in 12 months is putting out this inflation fire. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and this is why I say that I am not as convinced that Powell is going to reverse and start cutting, or either pause or start cutting, as everybody else is. Now, here's the other thing I'd say. I'm gonna step back for a second, and I'm going to say, this is my belief, but I don't know, and neither does anybody else. So any shows you watch, anytime you see these commentators on CNBC, nobody knows what's going to happen. I don't care how long they've been doing it. I don't care what their signals are. I don't care what their process is. Nobody knows what's actually going to happen. But I think a lot of people are convinced that we just had the last cut and that it's very unlikely that we have a cut in September. Or so we just had the last hike and it's very unlikely that we have another one in September. I actually lean towards there being another one. Not because I think it's baked in and not because I have some great signal that tells me that I just happen to believe it's not going to be as easy as everybody seems to think it's going to be right now. And I think this is somewhat reflected in Powell's, not only his comments, but his forward guidance. And to your point you just made about where he used to be super clear, I think as we get closer to this potential Goldilocks soft landing, he's being not as clear. And I think this is a function. I think it's a function of him actually being a little surprised that he's gotten away with it for as long as he has. And here's what I mean by that. I am of the belief that he was not afraid to cause a recession in order to bring inflation down. And so I think that is why he was hiking. And I think over the last year, you can see that, or from last year until now, inflation is decelerating. Now, is it back to 2%? No. Can you declare victory? No. But the trend in data is going the appropriate way. And I think even in the last fall, he was willing to cause a recession to get the numbers that we're now getting. And I think the fact that this year that he's been able to continue to hike at a slower pace, but continue to hike, and for the markets to hold up, markets are basically back to where they were when he started this, maybe even a little higher than when he started this hiking cycle. And to think that he's gone from 0 to 25 basis points to 525 to 550 basis points, and VIX is at its all-time low, and that the markets are basically back to where they were when he started, that's pretty much the Goldilocks landing, right? I think he's gotten surprised that he is here. But now that he's here, he's like, holy shit, I might actually pull this off, right? And so now I think he's trying to be more careful with his language. Whereas 6 months ago or 9 months ago, I don't think he was as careful with his language because he didn't mind causing a recession. Now he's almost, wow, I could, you know, it's like a golfer on the 18th hole, we're about ready to win the Masters, who never thought he'd even be there. He's like, holy cow, if I make this putt, I'm the Masters champion, right? And he's kind of there, right? If they can, you know, go into a no more hiking and just a pause and markets hold up, he has engineered the soft landing. Now, I don't believe it's going to last. I don't think many people think it's going to last. And I think the majority of people thinks he's going to have to cave. But my point is, from his point of view, he's done a pretty good job, and he can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And that's why he's being more careful with what he says. This is my interpretation. I could be wrong. But I don't think he's ready to just run out there and say, we're at the end of the hiking cycle or at the end of this, because he doesn't have to, because, you know, if he just keeps it on the glide path that on the glide path the market's currently on, he looks pretty good.
Well, it's the difference of having nothing to lose to suddenly having at least something to lose, or one might argue everything to lose, because it seems like, based on your opinion, that's all it is. But it seems like he's certainly much closer to a soft landing than anyone ever thought he would be. Now, every week, to start off the week on a Monday, we do a peak of the week segment where we look at various economic data. So I'll hold off on sharing some of the information that's coming out next week, which will be somewhat of a decent follow-up to the last week's data. But not to go without explaining, and I think last week we did a pretty good job of defining a few things like market cap and put options and call options. Earlier in the year, we did an episode that was called Japanese Jawbone Roulette. And now that we're starting to kind of see a factor of overseas markets, what Lagarde had to say in Europe, and this potential widening of the band, or whatever verbiage Japan is using, I think it might be a good opportunity to kind of recap, why does the Japanese yen matter, and why potentially, if the yen does rise along with the dollar, this could cause a lot of problem for markets.
Well, part of the reason that the yen matters is, you know, the three big currencies in the world are the United States dollar, the euro, and the yen. Those are the three majors. There's other kind of, you know, mid-level ones, but those are the three majors. Not only that, that's not the only reason the yen is important. Part of the reason the yen is important is it has had these, I don't know, however you want to qualify it, as QE or extraordinary monetary policies, whatever you want to label that as, for decades now, which means interest rates in Japan are extremely low. What that means is that you can go borrow in yen at either next to zero or very little rate. You can take that money, you can go invest it anywhere in the world, and if you even get a 1% return, you're golden, right? And so the yen has become a carry trade currency. And so people have borrowed in yen, so they're short the yen. They take that and they go buy things like foreign bonds, they go invest in emerging markets, they buy infrastructure overseas, whatever, private equity, real estate. And part of the reason is because that financing is so cheap back in Japan. Well, and part of the reason that the financing is so cheap is they've had this yield curve control that have held rates down. Without the yield curve control, rates would not be at zero. They would be higher because, you know, now even Japan is starting to feel some inflationary pressures. Hard to believe, but they are. And so the market wants rates to be a little bit higher in Japan. And so as they weaken the yield curve control band and let it go from, let's call it 50 basis points to 1%, think about this, a 50 basis points to a 1%, that's a 100% move. It's not very much in absolute terms, but on a relative terms, they've just doubled the level of interest rates, right? So if you have borrowed a lot in yen, and it's, you know, you've levered that up, and then you went and bought assets overseas, and let's say that they're yielding 1, 2, 3%, nothing big, but just 1, 2, 3%, And now your borrowing costs have gone from 50 basis points to 1%, or what, or if they lose control, it goes to 1.5%. All of a sudden, your carry trade, your over-leveraged carry trade, is getting unwound at a time and a price you don't like. So the point is as rates potentially rise in Japan and those carry trades get unwound, all of that capital that is overseas comes flooding back into Japan to, you know, pay off that borrow or that loan. Well, what happens when that liquidity leaves those overseas markets and goes back to Japan? Now those overseas markets are losing liquidity. So that liquidity is coming back to Japan in that scenario, but those markets where those funds are invested are losing liquidity. And so those asset prices now come under pressure. And as those asset prices come under pressure, the prices fall. And as the prices fall, that leveraged bet becomes even more scary. And so it can create this vicious loop, just like what happened in 2008 with the real estate crisis, just like what happened in 2020 when we had the COVID crisis and all these leveraged trades got unwound and you just saw prices collapse day after day after day. That has the potential to happen with the yen. Now, is it necessarily going to happen? No, but this is the point why once you see the currency start to strengthen and interest rates start to rise, why it starts to throw up these red flags for all these yen carry trades that have been deployed around the world. So that is why the yen is a big deal. And in my opinion, the scariest things for markets would be if the yen and the dollar were rising versus all other currencies together. To me, that would be scary.
And the reason that would be scary is that you would have the two biggest potential in different scenarios, currencies and carry trade type of markets, especially even just recently with the dollar kind of taking it on the chin and being slightly weaker. Although, you know, you're getting real rates of return to real yields in the U.S. So it's not like a huge capital flight out of the U.S. But backpedaling to the point here is if you have all these other markets seeing downward pressure on asset prices, while at the same time, the dollar, the yen, and interest rates in both of those markets going up, to your point, you kind of have this doubling down of external force or external pressure to sell these assets and, you know, close out your trade in Japan or the U.S. before things really get out of hand. So it's not just, you know, one taking a bullet from one side. Now you're under fire from two of the biggest markets.
No, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, at the end of the day, liquidity is what moves markets. Earnings, yeah, they have an influence. What the politician says, yeah, that has an influence. But ultimately, it comes down to liquidity. And if a market has liquidity, it typically does well. And if a market doesn't have liquidity, it typically does poorly. So I think, the yen and the dollar are two of the biggest liquidity signals that I monitor.
Excellent. Really glad we were able to look under the hood on that topic. And I appreciate your views, perspectives, and expertise on it. Now, speaking of expertise, or at least X, what are your thoughts on the recent rebranding of Twitter to X and some of the activity and handle stealing that Elon has been up to?
Yeah, so the whole rebranding from Twitter to X, it's obviously caused a lot of conversations this week. And the funny thing to me is that anything that Elon is involved with, it's immediately polarizing. It's very much like Trump. You know, you either love him or you hate him. And I even kind of have this kind of, polarized view of him. And on the one hand, I think that he's, in many ways, full of shit, for lack of a better word. I think he's, he's a very much like a Barnum and Bailey huckster and salesman. And, will say just about anything to, get his way. But at the same time, he's the richest guy in the world, so he's doing something right. I kind of find it funny when people will say, he's an idiot or he's dumb or just automatically going to fail. Well, he's got a rocket company. He's got the biggest social media site. He's the richest man in the world. And, he's not exactly, destined to fail every time he touches something. Anyway. As it relates to the X being Twitter being rebranded X, I personally don't like it. I personally, I think Twitter has a lot of brand value. I think he is in many ways just throwing that brand value out the window. You know, it's kind of the same thing when Facebook moved to Meta a couple years ago, and then you know Google moved to Alphabet. And, you know, they did it in a way that still kind of kept Facebook below it and Google below it. And I don't think that's happening here with Twitter. So in many ways, I think he's just throwing the Twitter brand name out the window. And I think he's kind of doing it for personal satisfaction because all of his other companies have some kind of X associated with it. So maybe he's got some grand plan that I don't see. You know, somebody pointed out to me that he wanted to have SpaceX, you know, then the E and then the X. And you guys can figure out for yourself what that stands for. So maybe it's just him making a big joke, a $43 billion joke. But I also think it's kind of like everybody who's up in arms about it is a little bit, you know, they're still on Twitter talking about it. It's like the people who were going to leave the United States when Trump got elected. Oh, if Trump gets elected, I'm going to move to Canada. Well, they're all still here. Nobody moved to Canada. So, you know, whether it says X at the top or Twitter at the top, I don't really care. I'd prefer it was Twitter, but you know, I'm still going to be here if it's X.
Well, I think the brand equity point is valid. You know, these other companies, they really just restructured how the corporate ownership is. But those services or those tools still existed as everybody knew them. You know, some also argue that it is a bit of an ego play. He didn't want any of that old Twitter association to exist anymore. I forget the term for it, but this idea that someone who is good at executing one idea or has really profound thinking, or one might say is a thought leader in a certain space, is therefore a genius in everything they touch and is an expert in every opinion that they have. And
yeah,
you know, maybe even Elon believes in that to a certain extent. I could see why. I mean, anyone who would have as much money as he does and has over time as much success as he had would, you know, you have to believe in yourself. But it's not going to happen. Whatever plan he has, whatever mission he has, isn't going to happen without mistakes. And I think that's something that gets in the way for people a lot of the time, especially on Twitter. Everyone is, you know, the greatest person on the planet and has had nothing but success and zero failures when it comes to Twitter debates. And I think it holds a lot of people back from being, you know, willing to make a mistake. But like you said many times, Twitter is and has been the arena. It's where everyone shows up to have these arguments and debates. And what logo is at the top probably doesn't matter a whole lot. And Elon probably has some sort of grand scheme where there's commerce happening on the site, and it becomes more than just this, you know, short text, yeah, mini blogging app. But you know, we shall see, and time will tell. But for now, that's it on X. That's it for Milkshakes Madness, and Markets, Milkshakes Markets Madness. Spin it however you want. See, Elon has already intercepted and melted my brain. We're rebranding our show real time. So we're no longer Milkshakes Markets Madness. We're now MMM. So make sure that you don't get confused with other fantastic video channels that might be branded the wrong way. Anyway, so Brett, glad we could catch up this weekend. I think everyone's going to love this conversation. We covered a lot of stuff. We covered themes and ideas that we talked about before, but it was great to recap it. It was also great to kind of get a little deeper on some of those. So we appreciate you taking the time. Anyone who's new to the show, enjoyed this conversation and wants to learn more, you can find out more at milkshakespod.com. We also encourage you to visit our YouTube channel, which you can find at the handle milkshakespod. The channel is very well organized for people. We have a number of playlists at the very beginning. There's a Start Here playlist, which will help you better understand really who Brent Johnson is, the man across from me right now, and his dollar milkshake theory. We also do a weekly show at the start of the week called Peak of the Week. We do a midweek update. We do various clips from our different conversations, which we think will be impactful. All of that is broken down into some pretty easy playlists to follow. So if you want to get caught up or you just want to binge on our content, I think it's all laid out there for you very, very well. If you want to follow Brent on Twitter, or what is now known as X, or whatever the heck it is, you can do so at Santiago AU Fund. You can follow me at John Katsumita. And I think that does it for us this week. Brent, any last words?
No, I'm going to. I'm looking forward to Barbie tonight. You know, I just got to bookend it with that. You know, I think Ken is going to be a real player in this, and you know, I think his story needs to get out there and be told. So, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with that.
Well, we look forward to having you share your story after your weekend cinema experience. So, everybody, thanks for taking the time. We look forward to seeing you in a couple days. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.